affluent New Jersey suburb of Glen Ridge in March of 1989. A group of the community's star high school athletes raped a retarded girl. The high school-aged victim had grown up with her attackers. Our guest is journalist Bernard Lefkowitz. He's written a book about the crime and the community of Glen Ridge. The book is titled Our Guys. You can join our discussion this afternoon with a telephone call. Questions and comments are welcome in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. Outside Champaign, you can call us toll-free, 1-800-222-9455. Bernard Lefkowitz has reported for the New York Post, Newsday, New York Times Magazine, and the Washington Post. He's the author of four books of nonfiction and is an adjunct professor of journalism at Columbia University. His book, Our Guys, is now out in paperback. Bernard Lefkowitz, good afternoon. Welcome.
Thank you for having me.
Well, thank you for agreeing to be on the program.
My pleasure.
Our guys, our town, golden boys from good families in a golden town, small, quiet, middle-class suburb. Glen Ridge was seen as a very desirable place for raising a family. What made it so?
Oh, I think it's the kind of place that if you're caught in a traffic jam in Chicago or in Times Square in New York, you dream of being in. It's a town with cobblestone streets and gas lamps, with no commercial activity, almost. I think there's one small candy store in the town. It's a town of about 7,800 people, all upper middle class. And at the time that this crime occurred, it was basically an all-white town. There was a scattering of a few black families and a few Jewish families, but it was very homogenous.
Yeah.
So it also had an excellent school system. 85% of the graduates of the high school went on to college, and there were very few problems. The ratio of teachers to students was about 1 to 15. So in many ways, it would be considered a very desirable place to live.
Mm-hmm. And the glue that held this community together, in large part, was sports.
Yes, it was. I mean, I think that there were various community organizations, but the one factor that drew many people together was the Saturday afternoon football game. And if you were not an ardent fan, and if you didn't make an appearance, and if you didn't support the team, you really weren't regarded as a true Ridger, as people were called in Glen Ridge.
Yeah. And being a fan was important. Being an athlete was important, not only, you know, as you were growing up in Glen Ridge, but it would pay off. It would pay dividends when you were an adult.
Oh, sure. And I think it was a way that people who weren't as affluent as others could achieve a measure of equality, because if your son played football or you had played football in the high school, you could leap a couple of economic steps in the ladder and achieve at least a momentary equality. You became a prominent person in the community if your son played football. And I emphasize the word son because even though young women played sports, it was certainly not in the same ballpark.
No, uh-uh. Now, the victim, a girl you call Leslie Faber.
Yes.
She's an athlete. She loves playing baseball and basketball.
Absolutely.
And she wants and she needs to be part of this community.
Oh, she does. I mean, the most important driving force in her life is to be accepted, and especially to be accepted by those young people in the town who were active in sports and who were good athletes. Her great moments came when she played softball or even basketball. I mean, she was always the last kid off the bench in a basketball game, but it really didn't make much of a difference because she was part of something and she was being accepted. And her whole adolescence was a search for acceptance.
Hmm. What is the extent of Leslie Faber's disability?
Well, these are always rough yardsticks, but I think she was regarded as having an intellectual level of a second grader in elementary school. And she would be considered, I think, a kid who could found it very, very difficult to read motive. And by that I mean she would never try to discern the real purpose behind a suggestion or an invitation or a request. If you said to Leslie Faber, "You're looking wonderful today, Leslie. Come join me," she would regard it as a high compliment, and she couldn't discern an ulterior motive, I think.
Yeah. She seems incapable of understanding that someone would be capable of hurting her or would want to hurt her.
Right. Unless, of course, you know, somebody started out that way.
Right.
If they did something that was terrible to her. But even when they did something terrible, you know, when she was 6 years old, two of the boys who were later found guilty in her rape fed her dog excrement at the tip of a ballpoint pen and told her it was chocolate. And she ate it, and they asked her to eat it, and she ate it, and then and she realized how horrible this was. But then the next week, you know, despite her parents' urgings, she went out and tried to play with these boys. I mean, this was she regarded as just a kind of initiation rite, and if she did what they asked her to do, she'd be accepted.
Yeah, she was a girl who didn't know how to say no.
Right. I mean, you know, she could say no. It's one of the problems you have, I think, in talking about people with mental disabilities is that we tend to typecast them and stereotype them and see them as one-dimensional people. But I think, you know, if you said to Leslie, "You can't go to a movie tonight," Leslie would be upset by that. Or if you said to her, "You know, Leslie, you know, you're really ugly," she'd be upset by that. It isn't that she can't say no and she doesn't have those feelings, but it's very, very difficult for her to say no to a request from people she admires, and she admired these young men more than anybody.
Mm. Tell us what happened to Leslie Faber on March 1st of 1989.
Well, she came home from her school where she attended a special class for kids who were mentally handicapped. Had a glass of milk and went out to play at the Glen Ridge Community Playground called Carteret Park, and it was the kind of place that would seem absolutely safe. It was surrounded by tree-shaded streets and small houses, and she had been playing in the park all of her life. And she went out to play and shoot some baskets, and at the same time, the high school baseball team was practicing in an informal practice along with a bunch of other guys who were friends, and a couple of them came up to her and said, "Leslie, would you like to attend a party?" And the party was going to be held at a house that adjoined the park, which was occupied by the co-captains of the high school football team, Kyle and Kevin Schertzer. And Leslie, you know, had a moment's twinge where she asked herself, as she would later say, "Why would they invite me to this party when they never invited me to anything else in my whole life?" But that suspicion was overridden by the fact that she was promised a date with one of the football players who was regarded as the most drop-dead handsome. You know, and then after the rape occurred, she went out back into the playground and walked back and forth between the pitching mound and home plate, waiting for this young man who had been promised to be her date to show up, and of course he never did, and ultimately she went home.
Mm.
I should say also that of the 13 boys in the basement, six left.
Right.
And the six left, depending on who you believe, either in the preliminary stages of the rape or maybe even a little later than that. But the thing that's notable about them is that they left, and they never told anybody.
Mm-hmm.
And they didn't tell their parents. They did nothing to stop what was going on or to intervene. And later, when they were called, when they were questioned by the prosecutor in the case, and when, in fact, three of them were called as witnesses by the prosecution in the actual trial, they all had convenient lapses of memory. It was very hard for them to recall who was doing what and who was saying what, and their view was always being blocked. So while they themselves voted with their feet by leaving the basement, on the other hand, they remained loyal to their friends and fellow athletes.
Yeah. This was a premeditated attack. Chris Archer luring Leslie Faber to the basement with the promise of a date with his good-looking brother.
Right. I mean, when we say premeditated, I'm not sure that they had planned this for days or weeks before, but certainly a plan had been formulated at that playground.
Right.
And there's no question in my mind after, you know, interviewing a couple of hundred people and spending 6 years working on this book, there's no question in my mind that every single boy who went down into that basement with that young woman had a pretty clear idea of what was going to happen.
Yeah.
And I mean, they may not have known. The bat and the broomstick may have been spontaneous, but they knew that they were going to have sport with her. And they also knew, you know, it's a cliche to say it, but I think it always is worth repeating, they also understood that it really had nothing to do with sex, but everything to do with exerting their power which they had held for so many years in this community.
Well, this girl was not a human being in their eyes. At least as I read your book, I mean, that's what I come away with.
Yes. She certainly wasn't a human being who counted for anything. You know, she might be a human being in the sense that they were driving along a street and she was crossing against the light, they would stop and avoid trying to hit her with their car. But she was not a human being in the sense that her feelings, her emotions, her well-being, her welfare was of any concern to them. But, you know, honestly, there were very few girls whose welfare and well-being and sensitivity and emotions were of concern to them.
Right.
You know, I've often speculated and thought, if it hadn't been Leslie Faber, could it have been or would it have been another young woman, perhaps one who wasn't mentally handicapped? And I think that these guys, with their background and their experience in this town and the degree to which they were venerated, would have tried something similar with another young woman if that opportunity had arisen.
There apparently was an effort to lure her back.
Yes. The next day, you know, there were two things that interested me that got me involved in writing this in the first place. And one was the number of boys who were in the basement when this crime occurred. This was like a third to a half of the seniors. And Glenridge had a small high school, 100 students. And roughly a third to a half of the boys in that senior class showed up in the basement. The next day, more than two dozen boys, juniors and seniors, athletes and their friends, gathered in front of the house where the rape had occurred and passed around the bat and the broomstick as though they were trophies after a game. And then they approached Leslie, who was playing in the playground, and asked her to come back to the basement, where they planned to repeat what had occurred the day before, and this time videotape it. And the presence of so many young men the day after this happened suggested to me that what was going on was not an aberrant act by a couple of kids gone wrong, the kind of thing we always read about, bad apples, but something that was really woven into the culture and the values of this town.
The boys talked about it at school, and yet it didn't come to the attention of adults for a while.
Not only did they talk about it in school, they boasted about it.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, they went into the cafeteria the day after the rape had occurred and said, guess what, you know, we raped a retard yesterday. And they thought they were so powerful that nobody would punish them, even though they boasted about it. And they had boasted about many other of their activities, which were questionable in the past, and there had been no punishment for that. So I think they were pretty confident about that.
Yeah. In your opinion, why did no one speak up? Except for there was one young man who did. He told the teacher.
Right, right. Well, I think there was this sense that these young men ruled the town in a popular way, in the sense that they were the prominent athletes in the town. They had always been given a whole lot of attention and special privilege by the schools, by the community, by the parents, although they had a very compelling record of misbehavior and misconduct throughout their adolescence. And I think the sense that that we have to close ranks and protect our own and protect these guys was much more important than what would happen to one retarded young woman. And I know it sounds cold-blooded to say that, but I believe that most of the most of the students felt this way. There was, it's important always to say, there was a small group of both students and adults in the community who felt that something outrageous had occurred, but they didn't really know the extent of what had occurred until much later. And I think if it hadn't been for that one, he was one of three black students in the entire high school. He was an athlete himself, and he had heard about what had happened the day after, and he was discussing it with another student, was overheard by a teacher, and then told the teacher what he had learned. And even though he told the teacher, it took the teacher 2.5 weeks to report it to other teachers. And I think it's important to also note that Leslie told her own swimming teacher within 2 days after this occurred. So something terrible happened. People had put things into her body. This was a group of boys. They invited her to a party. All of this, and yet it took 3.5 weeks before the school notified the police. I don't think there's no question in my mind that the specter of scandal and something that might ruin the reputation of the school and the community was regarded as more important than what had happened to Leslie Faber.
Yeah. You tell a story in the book about a young man by the name of Bryant Grober. When he was 12 years old, he comes to the rescue of a girl you call Jacqueline Davis.
Yes.
And Bryant Grober was one of the boys in the basement.
Yes.
But anyway, when Bryant was a 12-year-old, he did something that was rather courageous for a 12-year-old boy to do.
Jacqueline Davis was a young African-American woman, and they were at a party where they were playing Spin the Bottle, and the bottle turned to Jacqueline Davis, and nobody would kiss her because she was black. And Bryant Grober, who at that time showed a certain humane response, said, "Well, if you're not going to kiss her, I'm going to kiss her." And he got up and kissed her. And Jacqueline Davis always remembered that, you know, and regarded Brian as somebody special, somebody different. But by the time, you know, they were in high school together, and he was a teenager, and he was part of this group of athletes, he joined in when the others made racial slurs and, terrible comments about her racial and origin, was not prepared to dissent later on.
So what happens to these kids in the space of 4 and 5 years in town?
Yeah. Well, what I think happens is membership in a group that's exalted in this community. And more important, where the group takes on values and behavior that it really, in normal society, would be regarded as criminal. And I think we could talk about it in detail, but I think people should get a sense of what these guys did during the years of their growing up, and Brian was part of that group. These were kids who exposed themselves and masturbated in class. They wrecked the homes of young women they didn't like at a cost of many thousands of dollars, in one case almost $15,000. They practiced voyeurism, which they watched young women when they were having sexual relations or even when they were going to the bathroom, and they hid in closets and watched them through the windows. They stole hundreds of dollars from young women, including women who regarded themselves as friends of theirs, at the most important high school dance of their high school years. And they boasted about this, and they even put it in their high school yearbook. And nobody punished them. So I think they took on almost the quality that you might see in a lynch mob in the 20s, where there was a group feeling and values, and that nobody's going to stand up to us, and we're going to push the envelope as far as we can, and we're going to show how powerful we are by abusing and mistreating as many people as we can.
Yeah. So there were indications for quite some time that these guys were trouble.
I think it's fair to say, even from their elementary school days, but certainly when they were in middle school, junior high school, it was real clear they were the core group of kids who disrupted school, who particularly picked on young women and exposed themselves. And if they were rebuked, it was a mild rebuke. They would spend, you know, an hour after school, but they weren't referred for psychiatric treatment. They weren't any punished in any more serious way. And in fact, they were moved from year to year being promoted because teachers didn't want to hold them back, because they would have to deal with them again in their classes. So I think there was generally a sense that these kids were serious trouble, and as much as 20% of the parents who had school-age children took their kids out of the school system, and at considerable cost put them into private schools in other communities, because they were so concerned about the power that these guys wielded. But they were identified at an early age, and I think it's really important to understand that, because it's this unwillingness of the community and the school to confront difficult problems, particularly problems that have a sexual coloration, that played a large part in what happened. What happened to Leslie Faber on March 1, 1989, was just the culmination of a long-standing pattern of misconduct that had been ignored by people who could have done something about
mm-hmm.
it.
And these guys were also, they were so indulged because of their achievements in sports. At homecoming, you write about how the cheerleaders decorated their lockers. Well, okay, that sounds reasonable. But the doors and fences of their homes,
yes.
And their bedrooms,
yes.
And cakes and cookies and all kinds of goodies, bras and panties were left
in their locker.
In the locker.
Right, right. And other stuff, yeah. Yeah, no, I mean, there was in that school, it's interesting that power and sexuality converged in a way around these guys. And that for a young woman seeking to be part of the social world and the social life of the community, to be invited to the most desirable parties, she had to make herself available to these guys. It didn't always take the form, you know, of sexual availability, although it did quite often. But it also took the form of defending these guys, writing letters for them when they got into trouble in school or when they became ineligible for sports. So they became, some of these young women actually became little mothers, and they formed this cordon around these guys. And they were the ones who woke up at 2:00 in the morning when these guys pounded on their doors and demanded a late night dinner after a night of carousing. And without objection, they went ahead and did that.
Mm-hmm. 1989, and in Glen Ridge, gender rules.
Well, you know, a lot of people have said, and you know, again, it's kind of a cliche, but I think it's true that the idea that boys will be boys, which was prominent in the 1950s, was still very, very important in Glen Ridge in the 1980s, and I think today. I think in most of these families, these boys' lives and characters were defined by the males in the family. Although women worked and held important jobs, they were not the people who made the rules in within the family. And in the school, while most of the teachers were women, the environment and the rules were really set by three middle-aged men who ran the high school and who had all had experience in athletics as coaches. These were decent people. That, you know, I would never say that they were dishonorable people, but I don't think very many young women who felt persecuted by these guys could go to these men and say what they really felt and feel that it would be held in confidence and that something would be done about it.
Mm. Our guest this afternoon, journalist Bernard Lefkowitz, he's written a book, Our Guys. The book is a look into a crime and the character of a community. The crime, a gang rape of a retarded girl, took place in the New Jersey suburb of Glen Ridge in March of 1989. a group of the community's star high school athletes.
Just to try to look at the character of a community and try to understand what the values were that underlie what happened to Leslie Faber and how these guys behaved, and to try to understand how boys are raised in America, and particularly how they're taught to treat young women. I thought that Glen Ridge, I never was interested in Glen Ridge as a mystery in the conventional sense of a place where you want to find out who did what. But I was always interested in it in terms of discovering why it occurred, and I wanted to go back in the history and try to follow the lives of these young men and these young women from kindergarten, even before that, through the rape, and then into the criminal justice system.
All right, and then I wanted to ask the question. You keep bringing up the mental retardation of this victim, but you also say that it could have been somebody else, some other girl, too. But I'm mainly interested, what is the assessment on the mental retardation of all the boys?
Well, I don't think any of that. One of the young men was actually classified, which is a nomenclature used to say that they received special services. He received special services when he was in elementary school, but then was brought back into the mainstream of the school population. But these were not, for the most part, these were not high academic achievers. We were talking about kids who barely passed and barely got to graduate, with the one exception of the kid who was the catalyst in this, Christopher Archer, who had a very high IQ. But we can talk about high IQs, but if we want to talk about social IQs, capacity for compassion and empathy, they rated very low on the scale, much lower than Leslie Faber did.
Yes, I would say their maturity was all retarded. And it would seem to me that there would be teachers that would be aware of all of these students.
Absolutely. They were. I mean, and I interviewed them, and they felt powerless. But I have to say, it's important to look at it in a real way. And the real way was that Glen Ridge was a plum job for a teacher. This was a basically a crime-free school, a school that had excellent facilities, a school where most of the kids went on to college in a rich town, and teachers were reluctant to speak out, to go against the prevailing wisdom, and to raise warnings about what was going on. And if they did, they were not necessarily rewarded for that. They were often ignored. The answer is yes. It was absolutely impossible to ignore how these young men behaved because they boasted about it in class, and they made very clear what they were doing, but nobody did anything about it.
Mm. I want to thank the caller for her call, and I want to go on to our next caller on line 2 in Urbana. Hello.
Yes. Whatever happened to these people? Were they ever punished?
Well, there was a trial in that occurred 3.5 years after the crime, and in that trial, three young men were found guilty of first-degree rape, and a fourth was found guilty of conspiracy to commit rape. But it's important. Two things are important about that. One is that the judge let them free after the trial was over to await their appeal, which is really a very unusual decision. And it took 4 more years until last June for their appeals to be exhausted and for them finally to be sent to prison. And they've been sent to a prison which is a minimum security facility, which is basically a work camp in the mountains of New Jersey. They live in stone cottages that are dormitory style. But it was 8 years before they served a day in prison for their crimes. And the other thing that's very important to know about the trial is that as so many rape cases develop, In the trial, Leslie Faber's background, her life, her reputation, her sexual behavior became, the defense made that into the central issue of the trial. And every shred of gossip and rumor and innuendo about her was introduced into evidence, although there was no support for it. But not a single word was said about these boys' characters and what led up to the rape.
Oh, my word. This is very, very sad.
It is sad, and even though I've spent so many years talking about it, I still get angry when I recount what had happened.
Yes, I agree. Well, it's a terrible reflection on society and on the courts and these parents. It's utterly devastating. Well, thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thanks for your call this afternoon. I think I want to thank you for doing this book and for talking about this, because I think it can get all of us thinking about how healthy are our communities and our schools, and are we, you know, unwittingly
that's right.
Contributing to,
right.
You know.
You know, the thing I always try to say is that there was nothing wrong, you know, with the water supply or the gene pool in Glen Ridge. I mean, Glen Ridge resembles 1,000 other communities around the country, you know, and whether it's Grosse Pointe in Detroit, where in Michigan, where recently a group of prominent athletes and very wealthy young men were arrested for sexual misconduct with very young women, or other, you know, that communities that are part of of our culture that are just like Glen Ridge. I mean, and also that in Glen Ridge's case, it was a group of high school athletes, but in other communities, it could be the richest kids or the preppiest kids or the kids who drive the most attractive cars, or, you know, I mean, and the sense that that to try to engage these issues is something that would cause scandal, and communities trying to avoid it at all costs, I think, is just something that's very prevalent in American culture. The sad part of it is that when we read about the Citadel, or we read about college fraternities, or professional football teams, or military bases, and we say, isn't it terrible that these men are doing that? But we don't think about how the characters of young men are formed when they're 12 and 13 and 14 years old.
Mm. Achievement is very important to Glen Ridgers. What achievement was, how it was measured, though, was pretty screwed up. There's a former minister of the Congregational
yes.
Church who was very bothered
yes.
about the idea of achievement in Glen Ridge. That place was seen as achievement, station in life.
Yes.
You also write in the book that compassion for the weak was not part
right.
of the system
right.
there.
Right.
Yet. Yet in your descriptions of the families of these boys, particularly the Archer family and the Nathan family,
right.
the parents have a sense of social responsibility. Where did the families go wrong? Where did parenting
right.
break
well,
down?
Right. Well, I think with all these families, if you looked at them in profile, you'd say, well, these are admirable families. They belong to church. They were not only belong to churches, they were active in churches. They were active in civic affairs in the community. They try to help people who are in difficulty, when their marriages were in difficulty, when they ran into economic difficulties. They were always generous in their support. But that was with the outside world. Within the world of the family, I think, like a lot of other families, this idea that if you were a boy, you had to behave in a certain way. You had to be tough. You had to be aggressive. You had to be competitive. And you also were expected to go through a period where your behavior was less than admirable, because that's what boys were supposed to do. And I think, you know, if these parents look back at what had happened, I think to this day, they don't believe that what occurred in the basement was a crime. They believe that what happened there was an excess, that their sons had, you know, gotten out of control, gotten carried away by the situation, but that this was a consensual act, and that because it became a national scandal and the country was riveted by what had occurred in Glenridge, they were railroaded into prison. So I think they were, while in many ways they were compassionate people, they did not teach and compassion in the raising of their sons, especially. I think it's also notable that the major, with the exception of Brian Grober, the people who were primarily involved in the rape of Leslie Faber did not have sisters of their own and grew up in a family where males really dominated and set the rules, especially for the standards for male behavior, including older brothers. And I think some of these kids felt uncomfortable with the role that they've been put into, that they were not kids who wanted to personally mistreat young women and engage in the grossest behavior, but felt that that was the standard they had to live up to. That was the role they had to play if they were going to be athletes in Glenridge.
Are parents there aware of the pressure on their sons to be jocks?
Oh, yeah. I mean, not only aware in the pressure of the pressure, but subscribe to it as though it was some kind of exalted state. You know, most of the listeners should be aware. These, I think you described them at one point as the stars of Glenridge, but these were a group of pretty mediocre athletes. I mean, their football team, you know, was not winning any national championships.
Right.
And it, despite their mediocrity, they were regarded as being very admirable for being athletes. But I think that there was the sense that that if you weren't an athlete and you didn't support athletes, you weren't masculine. And I don't think it's an accident that both parents and students referred to kids who played in the band as band fags. I mean, that was the phrase, that was the label that they used, that you were less than masculine, you know, if you didn't behave as these boys did. And that was not only playing sports, but in terms of your character. If you didn't, if you weren't as tough and unfeeling and manipulative and cruel as these guys would be, you weren't really masculine.
Mm-hmm. It's striking that these families were so traditional. We often hear that if only we could go back to a time when.
Right.
And
right.
That's no panacea.
Right. Well, yes, although it's interesting because I think it was a whole new infusion of families in Glenridge, which was a very white shoe aristocratic community for a long time. And then in the 1960s, there was an infusion of other families that had come from surrounding cities, particularly cities which had deep racial conflicts like Newark, and were looking for a pretty much of a white bastion that they could move into. And for these families, this was really their first generation of money. And I think one of the elements that contributed to what happened in Glenridge was this sense that if you give your kid all this good stuff that the kid wants, you know, the best baseball glove and the best CD player and, you know, the best car, that you don't have to do a hell of a lot more, that you can go to Florida and you can go to Aspen and you can enjoy your money. And I think there was a pattern, both in terms of some of these ruinous parties where homes were left by parents, and you had kids with 13, 14, and 15 who had the run of their homes for 4 or 5 days in a row, and also people who left for longer periods of time. And if you looked at the school records of some of these guys who behaved miserably, every time they got into trouble, in the school records it would say parents gone on vacation or parents away for 4 days. And I thought it was pretty notable that this rape occurred during the week that the parents of these two boys who lived in this home, these parents were in Florida that entire week.
And the boys, the Schertzer boys, were there in the care of their grandmother.
An aged grandmother,
yeah,
who really was ineffectual in that situation, who really, who at one point even poked her head into the basement where the crime was occurring, but I'm sure never realized just how monstrous these guys were behaving.
Yeah. Has Glen Ridge rethought itself since 1989?
Well, I think that the notoriety that has arisen as a result of the crime and the trial and I think the publication of this book has caused a number of people to reflect on how they're raising their kids. But I'm not confident that they have truly reevaluated what had happened. There's a large number of people who still... I know it must sound amazing to people who are listening, but we're still in a state of denial that anything bad had really occurred, and that it reflected anything about the values of the town. I think it's positive that the school superintendent has asked all the teachers to read Our Guys, and I'm glad that that's happened. But also last Halloween, the students put on a performance in the school auditorium where some of the young men dressed as women, and at one point several of these young men were knocked to the floor by other boys who simulated a rape. And this occurred in an auditorium attended by everyone in the school, and maybe a third of the teachers, all women, got up and left while this was going on. But it seemed to me that if these guys, in 1998, could think that this was okay to do, that they had a license to make this kind of statement in public, that there still needed to be a little more rethinking of how kids were being raised. Mm-hmm.
And the woman that you call Leslie Faber,
yes,
what is she doing today?
Well, she's working in a mall in New Jersey, doing a menial job for a department store, wrapping packages. Her parents still continue to live in Glen Ridge, although most of the other boys who are involved in this, their families have left town. I think the ambivalence that she felt when she testified in this trial against her hometown heroes, she still feels that she knows on one level that what happened to her was a terrible thing, something that cannot be ever excused. On the other hand, she's not accepted in the society and culture of that community. And she feels that because she took action against these boys, because she testified, she'll probably remain a pariah. I think the other thing that has to be said about Leslie is that her personality remains as it always was, that she's a wonderful person, but she has a hard time understanding and interpreting motive, and that if some guy were driving a car down a street in Glen Ridge and she was walking on the street and he said to her, "Leslie, you look wonderful today, why don't I give you a lift?" she'd probably thank him and get in the car, So I fear for her sometimes.
Yeah. And it's so sad that here she could be a wonderful friend, and she wants to be a friend so badly.
Oh, yes. And she has, attributes that are so much, that are
right.
So wonderful compared to these guys. I mean, if you had attended that trial and you heard her being depicted as a Lolita, as a temptress, as someone who seduced these boys, and at one point one of the defense attorneys said, "How can we protect our own boys against this young woman?"
Right.
You would feel, this sense of revulsion, I think, that so many people felt as they read about that. It just seemed to me extraordinary that that kind of conduct by the defense. I understand how important it is for the defense to fully defend its clients, but that kind of defense seemed to me to be particularly cruel to Leslie and to her parents. I mean, at one point, her parents were blamed for this rape.
Yeah.
You know, the lawyers clearly implied that if they had paid much more attention to Leslie's development, that they would have been able to avoid this kind of thing.
We've got to wrap it up here. We're out of time, but we really didn't talk very much about the trial, but it seemed to me that the defense attorneys were like our guys, all grown up.
You got it.
I mean, they weren't grown up, but they were
physically
grown up. Thank you so much for talking with us this afternoon.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
Bernard Lefkowitz, our guest. Look for his book, Our Guys. It's out in paper now from Vintage.